From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the longtime powerful Chicago Alderman Ed Burke will soon be sentenced. Former House Speaker Michael Madigan set for trial this fall, and Madigan's former chief of staff has reported to prison to begin serving a sentence for perjury and obstruction of justice. It's a busy time for public corruption cases in the state. We'll update what's happening on those and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, good to have him back once again, we have Ray Long, an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Ray, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, as always, Sean. Thank you.
So, Ray, I want to start with Tim Mapes. He was the right-hand man for the longtime former House Speaker Michael Madigan. He entered prison this week, a federal medium security prison based in Florida. We've watched this case for many months. The verdict came down last year, and yet it's still sort of hard to get my mind around it, because for those that may have forgotten and didn't know him even, Tim Mapes was, you know, a meticulous fellow, very smart fellow, I think everybody would agree, and to find himself in this situation is just a strange turn of events. But sure enough, this basically, he's going to prison now, and it looks like for, I believe, 2 years, is that correct?
Yes, 30 months, so 2.5. He could get out with 85% time if he, you know, secures good time during that period. I'm told by folks who know him that he is pleased that he ended up in Pensacola as opposed to some other places he could have landed. And it's definitely a come down for this guy. But you mentioned he was a smart guy. There's no doubt about that. And one of the considerations, or one of the thoughts that is out there, is that he may have just thought he was too smart when he went into the grand jury and could outsmart the prosecutors. Not a good thing to do. Of course, he was convicted of lying to the grand jury about the Madigan investigation, and his answers were vague and unresponsive and did not really give the information that the prosecutors knew he had about relationships involving Mike McLean, the longtime legislator and close confidant to Madigan. You know, McLean was a guy who was so close to Madigan that he set up often in the conference room next to Madigan's main office and his suite. And the conference room sat in between Madigan and Mapes's office. It defied a lot of common judgment and common belief that Mapes knew a lot about what was going on, and the prosecutors couldn't get him to say too much of anything. And then they caught him in lies. The jury in his federal case actually checked off a whole bunch of boxes that were, any one of them could have caught him or been enough to convict him. And they checked all the boxes and said that he convicted him of perjury and attempted obstruction of justice.
Yeah, Charlie, I guess, like we said, he's a smart fellow, but a lesson here is you're not going to outsmart federal prosecutors. That's been proven over and over again. It is hard to kind of get your mind around what happened here, because was it just loyalty? Do we think that's what it was? I guess we don't know, but I know you know Tim Mapes going way back. Get your take on this situation now that he's actually reported to prison.
Well, that's the big question. Why did he not be more forthright, more candid when he was there before the grand jury? He had been given immunity, which meant that whatever he said could not be used against him in a criminal trial. So he was there like with a free pass. And that's the big question. And I honestly, I don't understand. I can't say why he did it, if it was out of a sense of loyalty to Madigan, or it was out of a sense, as you said, that, well, I can outwit these prosecutors. I just don't know. But now he's going to be in Pensacola till what, like July 2026 if he behaves himself. And in the meantime, his family is here missing him.
Yeah, and for people that don't know, when you go to federal prison, you can get out a little bit early, but it's not like state prison where you can cut your sentence in half in some cases, even more. So he's definitely going to serve the majority of his time for sure. The other question that I've heard from a few people since then was people saying, well, now he's going to flip on Michael Madigan. He's going to testify for the federal prosecutors. But, you know, we've discussed this in the past, and Ray, that's very unlikely now that his sentence has been handed down, mainly because he is a convicted, has been convicted of lying to that grand jury. So that sort of taints any testimony he could bring. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a good analysis there, Sean. It's really hard now. There are exceptions, of course. You've got people who are convicted liars who end up on the stand in other cases, but it's really hard to bring somebody out here already being convicted and sentenced to prison and then bring them back onto the stand in another case and say that they're telling the truth, if he's got anything to tell. That's the other question. Does he have anything that would hurt Madigan? And if so, what is it? That's something that he didn't give up in the grand jury. The grand jury testimony was actually played in court. I was in the courtroom when it was played. It was a long and arduous, and the federal prosecutor warned Mapes multiple times that he had been given immunity and he was to tell the truth, but he just didn't go as far as he could have, and he didn't outbluff them.
Well, I know that you haven't spoken with Michael Madigan, but you did write a book about Madigan, and that you have some insight into his personality. Do you think this sends a message to him in some way? Do you think that it changes his viewpoint of what he's up against here?
I take it that you're wondering if Madigan thinks this case that's facing him is even more insurmountable. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that he is going at this full blast. I mean, he's spent $8 million from his campaign funds to cover criminal defense fees. He's got some of the best lawyers in Chicago working on this case. And they've got this case, as you know, as we talked about before the show came on, we've got this Supreme Court case that challenges some of the same types of bribery counts that face him in his trial here. And that's one reason his trial was delayed. He was supposed to go to trial in April, but now there's this case out of Portage, Indiana, where a mayor is challenging the bribery counts and the roots of how they are, those counts are put together, and challenging whether or not they should even be considered bribery. He took, he was a mayor who gave out a contract for trucks to a firm and went back later after that contract was given to that firm, and they ended up giving him a contract for, somewhere around $10,000. I'm not quite sure what the figure was, but then that was considered bribery and an opportunity for the feds over there to zone in on him, and he was convicted and he's challenged that. And those types of bribery counts are the ones that Madigan himself is hoping to see them overturned so that maybe they could be knocked out of his case. Now, what could happen then? Well, he still has multiple counts that the feds could still bring against him and would bring against him. And they could retailer the bribery counts in another way if the counts are knocked down by the Supreme Court. But it is a long stretch, a long summer here. That ruling could come in the next few days or early July. And so were checking this U.S. Supreme Court decision docket every day to see what may be coming out of D.C.
Yeah, Charlie, you agree with that it could impact Madigan's case, but it doesn't get him off the hook completely with federal prosecutors, even if the U.S. Supreme Court decision goes the way he's hoping.
Yeah, I think that's true. It, as Ray said, it would, from Madigan's point of view, he's hoping that the decision will come down, clearing the mayor in Portage and thereby invalidating some of the charges against him the way they're framed. But as Ray said, the feds can change the wording and present things in a different light and maybe get around that Supreme Court ruling. And then again, the Supreme Court could say, hey, mayor, I'm sorry, but what you did, even though there was no quid pro quo ahead of time and they didn't give you a check before you gave them the truck contract, hey, that's still bribery. So we don't know.
Ray, is there any thought that if this does change some of the charges against Madigan, that maybe it might delay his trial a bit more? We might be looking at, you know, like you said, new indictments coming, something to that level?
Well, I think anything is possible. The judges could give prosecutors leeway if they wanted more time. But this is also a group of smart lawyers, just like Madigan has smart lawyers. The U.S. Attorney's Office has a group of smart lawyers prosecuting this. They may be prepared with a fallback position already. You know that Madigan would be prepared with a fallback position and is probably preparing for a fallback attack if the charges are upheld.
We'll keep watchful for that. There's also another case that is going through the federal court system. In fact, an already guilty verdict has come down for Ed Burke. You can make the argument, maybe the most powerful Chicago alderman of all time. He's 80 years old, former alderman now, and again has been convicted of corruption. His sentencing is coming up, Ray. What's that look like at this point? When does it happen, I guess? And then also, what's being asked for here?
Well, it's June 24th, and it is a case where the federal prosecutors are asking for 121 months. In other words, 10 years and 1 month in prison. And so his attorneys, his defense attorneys, are asking for much less, no time. He's been considered a guy who has fallen from the heights of power to a crushing reputation now that has cost him a lot of status, obviously. The balance here will be swung when the judge eventually comes down with it. But what was remarkable, and in this case just this last week, was that hundreds of letters got filed on his behalf. And these are letters from highfalutin people like former U.S. Attorney Dan Webb, of course, native of the Bushnell area of central Illinois, but he is a guy who is well known, revered in legal circles. And he came out and said that the judge should give leniency. There are others also of note who came out here, including the Illinois Supreme Court former Chief Justice Ann Burke, Ed Burke's wife, who was there every day, sitting in the front row of the federal courtroom while the entire trial went down. That trial ended just a couple of days before Christmas and a couple of days before his 80th birthday. And they were clearly crushed. I mean, watching Ed Burke walk out of the courtroom after the verdict came down that day, he was guilty of 13 out of 14 counts in a major racketeering case that basically came down to a variety of old-fashioned shakedowns. But watching him coming out showed, you know, a guy who really looked caught, you know, the deer in the headlights type of analogy is overused, but that is one time where you could definitely see a guy who was stunned by the verdict. I have never seen so many letters and so many glowing letters. They came from the legal community. They came from friends. They came from associates. They came from family. They sent pictures of Ed as a young boy, as a young man, as an older person, as a person wielding the authority in the city council. And it was really a sight that I've never seen in many, many years of covering federal courts. So it will be interesting to see how much weight the judge puts on these letters. And of course, the feds are going to come in and regale the judge with all of the shakedowns that were verbally and very descriptively rolled out in court on secret recordings that had been taken both over the phone and from a mole, a former alderman named Danny Solis, who went in wired with tape and video that caught Burke saying things like, have we landed the tuna yet? Meaning, have we landed any legal business? And a variety of others that have that are going to go down in Chicago City Council lore.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, Ed Burke is 80 years old. I know that judges, he's likely going to be sentenced to prison. We know that. We just don't know for how long. 10 years, though, when you're 80 years old, I mean, there's a good chance you may never come out of prison, just because you'd be in your 90s by that point. So do you think the judge is going to take the age into the case as well?
I don't know. Ray's probably in a better position to have a reading on Judge Kendall than I would. But I think one of the things that maybe will come into consideration, and the people who sent letters for him, as Ray mentioned, Dan Webb was one. Jim Thompson's widow, Jane Thompson, sent one for him. Father Flager, a very activist Catholic priest in Chicago, sent one saying that his dealings had always been upstanding with Burke. But whether or not Judge Kendall decides to listen to him, I thought the most telling one was maybe the one sent by his wife. The line that maybe we'll get to the judge was where Ann Burke wrote, quote, "I am devastated by the prospect that I will not be with Ed at the end of our lives." And so that goes back to what you were saying, being 80 years old, there's no guarantee that you'll be around in 10 years. And so whether or not the judge will take that into consideration, I don't know. I'm guessing were Burke only 50 years old, she'd give him the 10 years without a second thought. But when you're 80, that maybe does make a difference.
Yeah.
What the prosecutor said, and again, this is a quote from them, from what they wrote, as Edward Burke would have, a senior public official at the pinnacle of his power in the city of Chicago can solicit bribes, extort the lesser privilege, shake down local businesses for years on end, deny his guilt, express no remorse, and after refusing to accept responsibility, happily retire to the comfort of his own home after being found guilty on 13 counts of corruption, they wrote. And they noted that he was doing some of this crooked stuff while he was in his 70s. So it wasn't that he was doing it at a younger age and then kind of retired from his ill habits.
I think also, Charlie, to note another passage from Ann Burke's letter that was striking was she asked the judge, please find compassion through the Holy Spirit in your decision. I think she's reaching for the judge to call on her better angels, as Lincoln might say. Just as we're talking and recording this show here on Friday morning, I saw that the courthouse in Chicago, the federal courthouse, and has received a motion from Ed Burke's team that says he should have a delay in his sentence especially if the United States Supreme Court has not issued a ruling in this case out of Portage, Indiana, involving the mayor there by June 20th. So by next week, they want to know if they will have a ruling in the U.S. Supreme Court, and they say they need that ruling and they should delay the sentencing until they get it.
Give us a quick overview of another corruption case. Boy, they just keep coming. And this one involves AT&T, the company, and it has some ties to the former House Speaker Michael Madigan. What's going on there?
Well, you're right, Sean. This has been a busy season for corruption up here. It's one of these deals where I cover people in office and then cover them on the witness stand or in federal court. This one, however, deals with former AT&T president Paul LaScazia, and he is caught up in a corruption case where the feds allege that he agreed to put Eddie Acevedo, a former lawmaker who had retired from the General Assembly, onto a contract with Tom Kellen, a major lobbyist, smart political guy who was working for AT&T. And Kellen's had him on contract. And as a result, the allegations are that Acevedo really didn't do much at all for that, but he got the pay, and the pay was made through the elevating the size of the Cullen contract. And so the AT&T has paid a $23 million fine, and LaScazia has been charged as the top guy for AT&T, who expected this to be a kind of tit-for-tat arrangement. He even wrote emails wanting to make sure that Madigan knew that he was doing this. We will see how this turns out, but it looks like it has elements of a precursor or a curtain raiser for the Madigan trial, which comes up again in October.
All right. And then just a couple of minutes here, Charlie, real quick. Planned Parenthood came out with some news this week, some numbers, basically. They've been following since the Dobbs decision that came down by the U.S. Supreme Court. They have been sending out numbers of how many people are coming into Illinois to obtain abortions and other reproductive health services. The group says it has experienced now a 47% increase in overall patients over the past 2 years since that court decision, and also said that it's seen patients from 41 states over the past 2 years, and that accounts for 25% of all cases at these Planned Parenthood facilities. So I just want to get your take on that. Illinois, there was discussion, would become a haven for people seeking abortions and this type of health care, and sure enough, that does seem to be the case.
Roughly 6 months ago, Planned Parenthood opened a clinic in Carbondale, and the overwhelming majority of those getting care haven't lived in Illinois, they report. Three quarters of the patients served in Carbondale came from out of state, and 88% of those resided in states where abortion is restricted, like Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Missouri. So we really are a haven. And Planned Parenthood has set up clinics near the state's borders. There's one in the south suburbs, a few miles away from Indiana. There's one in Waukegan, which is less than 10 miles from the Wisconsin state line. And there's another one in Champaign, about an hour from the Indiana border. And all of those states severely restrict abortion, much more so than in Illinois.
Yeah, Charlie, also, yeah. I would think, though, that from a, you know, put a political spin on this, this issue is very big with progressives. We've got the DNC coming here to Illinois in just a matter of weeks now. J.B. Pritzker, you know, is going to get some stage time there. I bet we're going to hear about these numbers and how Illinois stands out here in the Midwest, I would think. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we are, and we've enacted legislation ever since Dobbs, several pieces that guarantee the right to an abortion here in Illinois, and also to provide some protection for people who come from out of state, women who come from another state. we won't allow our, what would you say, our law enforcement people to track people coming from another state and provide that information. Hey, you know, Charlie Wheeler went to this abortion clinic and he's from Indiana. So Indiana cops, here's that information. We can't do that. We won't do that. We've not done a constitutional amendment yet in Illinois. And the reasoning seems to be it's not needed quite yet. And we'll have to see how things develop. But yeah, we are much more progressive than anywhere else in the Midwest.
All right, time now for our notes from the field. And Ray, we'll go to you.
Just to go a few miles north of Illinois, the Donald Trump word horrible has really rocked the city of Milwaukee. Trump yesterday used the word horrible when he was talking to House Republicans in a closed door meeting in Washington, and he was using the word horrible in reference to Milwaukee. There's been a variety of interpretations based on what he meant by that, and disagreements from those who say, mostly Republicans, who are saying he meant it when he was talking about crime and alleged voter fraud. But Democrats, including Joe Biden, have seized on this. The Democratic mayor of Milwaukee has said it was an unhinged remark. And Joe Biden posted a tweet where he was celebrating the championship of the Milwaukee Bucks and said on the tweet, "I love Milwaukee." And of course, Wisconsin's a swing state. So anything that can cut through the din of arguments on either side of the equation for Republicans or Democrats will play a role in how that state goes for president one way or another. You know, it does make me think that there are people downstate who think, Chicago, it's a place I don't want to be. But and all in all, this is not a good thing to come out about Trump.
And Charlie.
Well, getting back to the subject of abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of days ago threw out a challenge to the Food and Drug Administration's rules for prescribing and dispensing abortion pills. And it was a unanimous vote. The opinion was written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and he basically said that federal law says that doctors can't be forced to perform or assist in abortions or to treat patients with complications from mifepristone, which is the main abortion drug. And he said doctors have never had standing to challenge the FDA drug approvals simply on the theory that use of the drugs by others may cause more visits to the doctor. And the significance goes beyond the prescription of abortion pills, which is by far the most common way that women choose to rid themselves of unwanted pregnancies. This challenge was to the ability of the FDA to issue rules and approving drugs for use across totally across the whole field. And it was interesting because siding with the FDA in this case were all the major medical associations in the country and all the pharmaceutical and biotech companies that are regulated by the FDA. And usually those two groups are at odds on a lot of issues.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Ray Long with the Chicago Tribune. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.